500K Boo listeners show top concerns 2 through 4 as cost of living, homelessness, and affordable housing. Every week, the Oregonian runs a list of the 10 most expensive homes sold in Portland, rarely any less than a million. Also, articles about whether mega company Live Nation or partly local group will build a close-in 4,000-seat arena for concerts that probably won't have any tickets less than 150. And KBOO listeners' number one concern, the climate crisis. As the wealthy gobble multiple shares of electricity and water, then go to the oh-so-beautiful Portland airport to fly to tourist destinations where the locals are protesting being priced out of their homes and towns. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 11th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Hannah Francis, myself, Josh Salem, and Dan Raphael. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Suzanne Potter, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, and Mike Moen. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. So fresh water, i.e. non-salinated water, is arguably the most precious resource on Earth, and in Oregon, by law, all water belongs to the public. However, if you examine who actually controls water usage in Oregon, you might come away with a very different impression. Water rights and the laws that govern them are incredibly consequential for both humans and ecosystems, and will only become more so in the coming years and decades. So a few months ago, I attended a talk with Christopher Hall, Executive Director of the Water League, focused on Oregon's push to modernize our water code in the 2025 legislative session. I came away from that talk super fired up about water rights, and I am excited to be joined by him today to talk about the Water League's efforts to reform Oregon's water codes. So let's jump right in. Christopher Hall, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very, very appreciate being here with you to talk about this important issue.
Well, let's start with kind of a high-level overview. What is the current problem with water rights in Oregon, and how does that negatively affect Oregonians and our environment?
So in Oregon, as you mentioned, water belongs to the public. However, less than 2% of the public actually has what are called water rights. And these are rights to use large quantities of water. They can pump water from the ground or from streams. The water is free at no cost. And there are restrictions as to how much and how fast you can pump the water and for what you can use it for. And since the 1850s, 1860s, there has been an enormous amount of water pumping that's gone on. And what they do is they pump it from the natural environment, wherever it resides, and then it comes into what we call the built environment. That might be your farm, that might be your city, that might be your house. But this area we built and walled off from the natural environment. And they actually use the term exports, and in terms of we're exporting the water from the natural environment and it's being imported into the built environment. And what we've ended up doing is using so much water, these water rights essentially permit the overuse of water. That's like actually what those permits do, is they permit the overuse of water. And when the population was small and when there weren't a lot of electric pumps and there wasn't a way to profit off of exporting agricultural products that used irrigation, there wasn't really a huge problem. But let's suffice it to say, in 1909, the problem was bad enough 110 years ago that the state passed the Water Code, which essentially controlled and regulated water uses on surface water. And then they did the same in 1955, and they passed a law that controlled and regulated groundwater because that was becoming a problem. But what's happening is that the permission to overpump our aquifers and our rivers has become so extreme that we're desiccating the Northwest, which, you know, we think of the Pacific Northwest as a wet region. But in fact, actually, this Mediterranean region, which is very dry during the summers, has been nearly pumped dry in some regions. And that's only been made worse by climate change because we've also been pumping a lot of oil. That's causing climate change. And so as drought increases, that makes the air a lot hotter, and it makes it suck up water off of the ground and off of plants, and it makes the irrigators pump ever so harder. And so the folks with water rights are diverting about, well, let's just say irrigation diverts 78% of all the water humans use in Oregon, and that water is essentially drifting away. And so the water rights essentially are permitting the desiccation of the state of Oregon. And one of the biggest concerns is that when we separate water from land, we desiccate and kill off the land. And that's just causing significant negative impacts. And for the future, it's going to cause serious problems because our descendants are going to be left high and dry.
Yeah, I just want to circle back to that one statistic about irrigators using 78% of the water in Oregon. And how many irrigators are we talking about here? Because something you touched on in a recent paper that you put out, talking about your recommendations for the Water Code that we'll actually link to and that are available on your website, waterleague.org. You know, you talked about just how the small number of people that are using such an outsized amount of water. You know, we talk about our urban areas and our personal water usage. So just talk for just a second about who's using how much water and who benefits from that.
Yeah, of course. So 78% of all the water we divert from the ecosystem is for irrigation. And that's not unusual for California and for other Western states. It's a vast majority of water. For comparison, 80% of all Oregonians live in suburbs or cities. They use municipal public water supplies, and that's 9% of all water. And that's including like industrial and big commercial uses like, you know, Facebook for server farms and you name it. So then we get down to home domestic wells. There are 225,000 domestic wells in the state of Oregon. That's like you have a house, you drill the well. And they only use about 1% of all the water in the state. If we were to just look at groundwater alone, just groundwater, not surface water, domestic wells use 4% of all the groundwater. And then irrigation uses 82% of all the groundwater. And then cities, they use 10%, and there's just a little bit left over for a couple other things. So that's like the layout in terms of like how much water is being used. A lot of times what we're going to hear is that, well, because everybody has a mouth and people get hungry 3 times a day and they want to wear clothing, that we're all responsible for irrigation use. Well, that's just not true, because in the great state of Oregon, we export 80% of all agricultural crops. In fact, Oregonians do not eat that much irrigation. We do not wear that much irrigation. And in fact, in Oregon, population and irrigation are not correlated. In fact, Population grew at almost an order of magnitude faster than irrigated acres did in the last 70 years. The irrigated acres plateaued over 70 years because there just isn't that much water left to expand it. And in fact, the number of Oregonians really has almost nothing to do with the number of acres we irrigate. It's just a fallacy to say that the residents of Portland are responsible for dewatering and draining aquifers and dewatering streams across the state. It's just not the case. And I think it's really important at this point just to point out that 5% of agricultural operations in Oregon are accounting for 80% of the industry, and that 95% of farms are small farms. They only account for 20% of the industry. They're the ones you see when you drive around mostly, and they pose almost no problems and no risks. I'm a big fan of the small family farm. I co-founded the Cave Junction Farmers Market, grew up on a farm in Vermont, and spent many years farming as an adult in Oregon and feeding my neighbors and supporting local agriculture.
Yeah, I think those are really important points. And you just went through a lot of statistics really quickly, but I think the high level or overly simplified recap of that is we are talking about a very small number of irrigators using an incredibly outsized amount of water. Most of that water then gets exported in terms of agricultural crops out of Oregon, usually not as direct food products. There's no correlation, as you say, between our population and the water usage. And we're not talking about the small scale and medium scale family farms that actually do feed us. So correct me if I'm wrong in any of that.
That is an excellent summary. And what I would point out is that the irrigation industry is a highly, highly isolated industry. It's less than about 1.5% of Oregonians have any contact with it whatsoever. They're the ones who economically benefit from it almost exclusively. Let's just put it out there. The business case for investing in water in Oregon, which is a new report that the Water Resources Department called for, shows that irrigated agriculture, which uses 78% of all the water in the state, only contributes 1.5% of our GDP to the state. Yeah. And, the amount of damage that is done dewatering streams every summer and draining aquifers, that amount of damage is not justified by 1.5% of our GDP. And for a state whose laws require that all water use be for the highest and best economic purposes, that's like the law, there's almost no justification for the damage that irrigated agriculture causes to streams and aquifers.
Yeah, well, I think this is a good point at which to discuss the recommendations that you've put out. Can you talk about the paper that you sent out in July, where people can find that real quick, and talk about your recommendations for water code modernization?
Yes. So the paper is called Modernizing Oregon's Political Culture. And it's all about modernizing the way we manage and govern water. And I want to give a big shout out, Governor Kotek. What a rock star. She has called for the modernization of Oregon's water code. And last year, this time, she had her staff put together a panel of four extraordinarily well-respected and smart water law attorneys who did a lot of research, and they did some scoping for what would legislation look like in the 2025 long session. And they came back with six priorities to consider after reviewing years and years and years of historic water use reports and plans and studies and so forth. They made their presentation to the House and the Senate Natural Resources Committees in the late spring. And now the legislature and the governor's staff and members of the communities across Oregon are working together to come up with a plan. Our call and what Water League is saying is great, modernize the water code because it is in dire straits of needing to be fixed. However, nothing good will come if we use the business and politics as usual, and we follow the conventional wisdom that basically says the largest water users are the folks who get the seat at the table and are the ones who provide all the information, advice, and consultation on how to set policy. We have over 110 years of their advice and their policy, and it's been an abject failure. And in fact, the reason why we need to modernize Oregon's water code is because the ideas from the past have proven over many decades to be destructive and harmful to the public interest and to the public health, safety, and welfare, and they imperil the future for water access to clean water, to fresh water, to cool water for both flora and fauna and humans. And so we're calling for a change in the way that our elected and appointed officials go about and do their business. And we are requesting that the change come from within and how they do business, and to stop prioritizing special interests at the expense of the greater public interest. And I'll just briefly say that the public interest is this larger collection of what is good for the entire public, and how does the public view some of the bigger, longer term concerns. Because a lot of times what happens is that a special interest will be like, well, I can go and make some money by pumping this aquifer dry. And I know exactly how much money I can make because we kind of have a good idea how much water's left in that aquifer. And so we're just going to treat it like gold. We're going to mine the water and get as much as we can. And if I have to ship the alfalfa out of state to make the most money, so be it, whatever. And meanwhile, the rest of the public who cares about their water sources and their future descendants' access to fresh, clean, cool water are left high and dry. And so what we're arguing is that the public interest must be upheld and serviced above and beyond all else first.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to look at some of this water usage as water mining, as opposed to, you know, because the rivers, they go down, you know, in the summer, they come back up in the spring, but especially with the groundwater usage, it is not a renewable resource, at least not in our time scale. So thinking of it as mining that water is actually useful, for me at least. So we have kind of two tracks or two things that overlap here. One is, you know, the specific policy outcomes that you want to see, and then the legislative mechanisms to get there and the need to change that legislative culture in order to get those policy changes. So I'm not sure if you want to tackle both of those together in a little more detail or separate those out and talk about one than the other, but I'd like to hear a little bit more detail on both of those pieces.
Sure. So the legislature is working with the governor to address the modernization of Oregon's water code. And in fact, I was at a recent Zoom meeting with where a legislator was, you know, holding one of their town halls, and I was just there watching it and listening. And the impression I got is that the forces of inertia are never more powerful than they are now. And in fact, actually, of the six priorities that the attorney cohort that was impaneled by the governor to scope out the modernization of the water code, well, maybe what we're looking at now is maybe only have enough money for one priority. And that is, I mean, that perpetuates some of the worst stereotypes of legislative and political politicking to try to kill something, to say, oh, we don't have the money for it, sort of mm-hmm. thing, right? Well, if you look at what the six priorities are, they don't really require a lot of money. In fact, the one priority that they are saying that they do have the ability to get to is efficient data collection. And there is no question that data collection is one of the most important priorities. That means metering the water rights that use the most water for commercial purposes. It does not mean metering other people's wells and that kind of stuff. But the other priorities are collaborative regional planning. That doesn't really cost a lot of money. Flexible water rights administration. That means being more flexible in how they manage water rights so that we don't have decades-long backlogs. Tribal inclusion and consent. That doesn't cost much money. Secure and equitable access to water. That doesn't cost much money. That's just like how we should be acting. And then the last one is sufficient funding to ensure the long-term health of Oregon's water sources and the fair distribution among its communities now and in the future. That's what we're talking about when we talk about politics and we're saying, oh, well, we don't have the money for this anymore. They don't want that last priority. I'm going to repeat that one more time. Sufficient funding to ensure the long-term health of Oregon's water sources and the fair distribution among its communities now and in the future. That is exactly in the public interest, and that is exactly not in the special interests. And the special interests have run amok over Salem for decades, and they're the ones who have basically, for all intents and purposes, they've almost privatized the public sector management and governance of water simply by their lobbying and their political control. And so when we talk about, or we hear, oh, we don't have the money for this, it's really, we don't want any resources put towards serving the long-term public interest. Because really, what does that mean? That means curtailing non-beneficial and harmful water uses in the short term and the present. And so that's what's going on right now in the legislature. And the and that's what's going on right now in the backroom politicking. And that's what's happening in terms of how people are lining up for who's going to manage and control this process, which is why we're calling for not just the modernization of the water code, but modernization of the political culture.
So how do we get from here to there? Because I think you're identifying something that a lot of us have experienced and is true about the, you know, the barriers to progress. So I guess my question is, how do we overcome those, whether you want to call them structural barriers or cultural barriers or both, you know, what, how do we get rid of that or circumvent those barriers?
Well, that is the $64,000 question. And I believe it is through community engagement. The problem that we all face is that we are very busy people in our lives and we don't have a lot of extra time. I mean, if we're going to soccer practice and if we're going to church on Sundays and we're having, you know, a Saturday off where we can actually take a breath for just a moment, it's really hard to add on to this community engagement around water use and water quality and making sure that we have water for the future, our future descendants. But really it means motivating the 500,000 people in Portland and motivating the people in Salem and in Eugene and in Ashland and in Bend and in every town and city across Oregon where people know that they have friends and families who are concerned about not just their own personal selves. That's the thing with the public interest. It's getting out of yourself and realizing that your concerns are for some people you don't even know. They're for the future people you'll never meet. That's like what it's about, is that it's engaging the public and the communities in something bigger than themselves. And I have found that when we feel like we're a part of something bigger than ourselves, we have a certain elevated, excited feeling. And so that level of engagement where we call for water use to be in the public interest. And what's in the public interest? It's water that does not harm the environmental health of the ecosystem. It is water use that is not separating so much water from the land that during our winters, it doesn't recharge and come back. And it's ensuring that we can have flora and fauna and future grandchildren who will live and live well and live as well as we did, if not better. You know, the folks from the past weren't really aware that they were foreclosing our water future. But we in the present, we know that now. And so it's our job to take action. So when we're told you have a duty to not waste water, so don't, you know, fix your shower head, don't water your lawn, you know, don't run the water when you're doing dishes too much, right? You know, we all have a public trust responsibility to hold water in trust and not waste water. Well, that public trust goes further, and that is holding water in trust by requiring and holding our own elected and appointed officials responsible for taking right action. So community engagement and getting involved and finding organizations in your community that address water. Water League, what's our name, Water League? Well, we advocate for folks to get in league with water. I mean, we are 60 to 70% water. We are water. In fact, our bodies are the closest to water that we'll ever get. And really, we're all just discrete hydrologic units of every watershed and every basin that we're in. And the river, I learned from Indigenous people who have shared with me how I am just more of the river that's flowing. And so how we treat water is how we treat each other, and it's how we treat ourselves. And if we are treating water badly, if we are desiccating water, if we're treating water like a thing and we think we can use it, then we can exploit it and we can extract it and we can abuse it. And yet we don't do that to our friends. We don't use our friends, unless you're like a psychopath. We don't use our family members. We don't exploit them and try to extract value from them. And so we shouldn't do that to water, because when we do that to ourselves. And so it's a change in how we think about ourselves, about water and our water future, and how we can get involved in various ways throughout the day and the week and the month and the year with each other to be the water that we want to be, not just for now, but for the future, and try to see beyond just the economic benefits of water, but the ecological, environmental, spiritual, and soul-based benefits.
Well, if that doesn't get our listeners fired up to help out, I don't know what will. So if they are, if you're listening to this and you want to get involved, Christopher, how can people learn more about your efforts or get involved in this legislative effort?
Well, you know, Water League does have a website. It's waterleak.org. My email is very simple. It's chris@waterleak.org. And I am always welcoming. I'm not one of those people who complains about having too much email. And we have a couple of Facebook pages. One of them is, you know, Water League's Facebook page. And you can just find that pretty easily. The other one is the Water Action Community, where it's a combination of education plus action. And the Water Action Community is a public group. You can ask to join it. And that's where we have discussions and you can connect with people. And we're just getting, you know, in this past year, we've been getting that started. And we're looking to grow that into a large statewide community forum. And then, of course, you can always visit our contact page on our website and reach out to us that way, too. To get in league with water. And again, that's really what it is it's the water of Oregon, and we're already all part of it. Let's celebrate that and let's share that together.
Well, we are going to have to leave it there. I would say one last thought is I feel like we should stop talking about water rights and start talking about water privileges, since as we, the public, own the water, a private individual doesn't then have the right to use it for their own profit. They have the privilege. So maybe that's something we should be talking about. But before we go, is there anything we've missed or anything you want to make sure gets included in this discussion?
I'd just like to return to my praise and my support for the governor's leadership on the modernization of Oregon's water code. Governors before Governor Kotek could have done this and they didn't. It is her visionary leadership that's doing this. And I also want to shout out to Representatives Ken Helm and Mark Owens, who are running the Natural Resources House Committee, who's going to be dealing with this issue, and to Senator Golden and Frank Girard, Senator Girard on the Senate side, they are the folks who are the gatekeepers to this legislation. And I know that they understand the problems, that they're under a huge amount of pressure, and they need our support. And they need our support to do the right thing and to be able to move forward with these priorities that are widely regarded as not just necessary, but crucial and critical, and to engage with them to support them in this process.
Okay. Well, Christopher Hall, Executive Director of the Water League at waterleague.org, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Michael, and I look forward to chatting with you about how to replace water rights with privileges in the future. That sounds like a fabulous idea.
Absolutely. Yeah, come back anytime as this process progresses, and we'd love to get updates.
Great. Thank you so much, and have a lovely day.
That's it for today's episode of Coast Range Radio. You can find all of our episodes at coastrange.org, and Coast Range Radio is also available on all podcast apps. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back in a couple weeks.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, wanna drive out to Seattle.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves